Greetings and salutations all, and welcome to the teleclass, The Changing Face of MRSA, Evolving Epidemiology. I'm very pleased that you have joined us for what will be a very interesting hour. Dr. Andrew Seymour is recognized nationally and internationally as a leader in the field of hospital epidemiology. He has published a large number of papers in scientific journals. He's on the editorial board of the Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology Journal. Dr. Seymour has received several teaching awards from his university, and in 2005, he was selected to receive the Distinguished Service Award from the university's Department of Laboratory Medicine. He has also received a CHICA Canada Award of Merit for his service in the advancement of infection prevention and control. And one of the reasons that I personally am so fond of this man is that he also travels regularly to Zimbabwe to work as a medical volunteer at a rural hospital. In fact, he just recently came back from there. He has assisted in establishing HIV and tuberculosis treatment programs in that country and does a lot of good work. And I hope you have the opportunity to talk to him about that someday, because it is certainly a fascinating story. Dr. Seymour is a great man, and he gives a great teleclass, this being his third. So to present the teleclass, The Changing Face of MRSA, Evolving Epidemiology, I am delighted to present Dr. Andrew Seymour. Andy.
Paul, thank you very much for your kind words of introduction. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening to all of you participating, depending upon which time zone you're in. I have been asked to talk about the changing face of what we here in Canada commonly refer to as MRSA. Some other parts of the world refer to it as MRSA. My wife is fond of calling it Mrs. A. But at any rate, this really is a remarkable organism, has a tremendous capacity to cause significant human disease and suffering, and also shows the tremendous ability to evolve over time, both in its virulence and its microbiological characteristics and its epidemiology. And that's what I'm going to try to address with you today in the next 45 minutes or so. The second slide quickly will deal just with my disclosures, none of which should really have any significant impact on my ability to present a balanced view today. The third slide summarizes the objectives then over the next little while. First, to appreciate the changing epidemiology of both healthcare-associated and community-associated MRSA. And secondly, specifically focusing on infection prevention and control strategies, trying to consider and evaluate evidence-based measures that have been found to be effective. If you turn to the next slide, it really just highlights what a remarkable pathogen Staph aureus is. Staph aureus is the most common cause of healthcare-associated infections, but it is also a major player in community-associated disease, responsible for infection at virtually any site in the body. The strain of Staph aureus that is resistant to antibiotics that we commonly refer to as MRSA is indeed the major antibiotic-resistant organism found in hospitals around the world. And what has changed most notably in the last decade has been the appearance and rapid spread of community-associated strains of MRSA. I should also be quick to mention that although the term MRSA refers to methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, this is, of course, a misnomer, because these organisms are not just resistant to methicillin or to the methicillin family of antibiotics, but indeed they are predictably cross-resistant to virtually every beta-lactam antibiotic, to virtually all penicillins, cephalosporins, and carbapenems, and are also very, very commonly cross-resistant to many non-beta-lactam antibiotics as well. And obviously that resistance pattern, this multi-drug resistant pattern, has a significant impact on the disease that the organism is capable of causing and on approach to treatment, which is much more challenging. If you turn to the next slide, you'll see a map of the world that was published in The Lancet a few years ago now, trying to illustrate the global prevalence of MRSA in countries around the world that have done surveillance. And when I look at this, I'm immediately struck by the tremendous variability in the prevalence around the world. Even in parts of the world where there are many countries in close geographic proximity, such as continental Europe, there are still significant variations, with some countries shown in the pale green or the dark green having very low rates of MRSA, less than 1 or 2%, such as in Scandinavian countries, in Denmark and the Netherlands, whereas other countries very nearby in France and Belgium and Germany having much higher rates of infection of 25 to 50% even. Same is said in North America, where rates, as we'll discuss in Canada, are somewhat lower than they are in the United States as well. And it begs the obvious question, why this variability in MRSA rates from countries even when they're so close together? Clearly, the organism does not recognize national boundaries. Certainly, our patients cross national boundaries with ever-increasing frequency. So there must be some other explanations. I don't claim to have the answer to this question. I don't think anyone does. But I think there must be a number of factors that probably play a role here, including differences in culture and screening indications and methods, as well as differences in how antimicrobials are used in various nations, and differences in infection prevention and control practices. I'm sure trying to answer that question itself would be the subject of a very interesting telehealth, and that's not my purpose today, but I'm always amazed when I look at this map to consider those differences. Now, obviously, working in a Canadian hospital in the Canadian environment, much of my presentation will focus on epidemiology in Canada, but I think it is important to recognize that the epidemiology varies somewhat around the world, and I would like to begin by alluding to data from the States, and this is Bill Jarvis's study looking at the prevalence of MRSA in U.S. healthcare facilities that was done in October of 2006. It was a point prevalence, this is now the next slide if after the map if you haven't already changed, a point prevalence survey looking at over 1,200 hospitals and nursing homes in the United States in October. And this represented a little more than a fifth of all U.S. healthcare facilities. And they found rates of MRSA of about 46 per 1,000 inpatients who were either infected or colonized with the organism, and if they looked just at infected patients with MRSA, the rates were 34 per 1,000. Now recognize this is prevalence, not incidence, and the authors acknowledge that this is probably a significant underestimate of MRSA prevalence in American institutions because they acknowledge that very few centers there do active screening for MRSA. The next slide is NIST data from intensive care units in American hospitals, and again you can see in the blue color that MRSA accounts for at least 60% of all the Staph aureus recovered from ICU patients. So these are certainly significant rates. The next slide gives you Canadian data from the Canadian Nosocomial Infection Surveillance Program. Many of you may be familiar with this surveillance program, but for those of you who are not, this is a network of some 48 sentinel hospitals across the country with good geographic distribution from across the country that has done active surveillance for a variety of healthcare-associated infections over the last 15 years or so. One of the first projects this started was surveillance for MRSA in Canadian hospitals, and this surveillance has been ongoing since 1995. These participating hospitals have worked in partnership with the Public Health Agency of Canada in Ottawa and the National Microbiology Laboratory in Winnipeg. And this graph shows the greater than tenfold increase in MRSA rates across the country over the last 13 years, from 1995 to 2007. The denominator here is rate per 1,000 admission, where in 2007 the rate was just under 9 per 1,000 admissions. Now, in comparing to Bill Jarvis's data, it's important to acknowledge, first of all, that this is incidence data, not prevalence as in his study. But in addition, I think we are comparing, to a certain degree, apples and oranges, because as I've mentioned, in the United States, most of those hospitals do not do active screening and therefore do not identify colonized patients. So the vast majority of their cases were infections, whereas in most Canadian hospitals, the standard is to do a lot of extensive surveillance and screening as part of infection prevention and control measures, and therefore many asymptomatic colonized patients are identified. And indeed, one might argue, maybe this increase is just because we're looking harder and we're finding more colonized patients. And that may be true in part, But at the same time, although I haven't shown you the data here, our infection rates have also continued to climb over this time. So there has been a significant increase in infections. And indeed, the next slide shows that overall, about a third of all of the patients identified in the CNS surveillance were infected patients. And the most common sites of infection were skin and soft tissue, surgical site infections, and respiratory tract infections, the MRSA pneumonias, especially in intensive care unit patients. In addition, because MRSA bloodstream infections are so very important, note that overall about 13% of all the infections were associated with bacteremia. And indeed, the next slide looks at the bloodstream infections from the other perspective, that is, of all Staph aureus bacteremias, what proportion were MRSA? And last year, in the United Kingdom, it was reported that a little more than a third of all Staph aureus bacteremias were due to MRSA. In contrast, in Quebec, it was about 24%. And in Ontario, it was about 19%. But this is important because no longer can we say that if you've got a blood culture, a preliminary blood culture report for gram-positive cocci, it's no longer safe, in my opinion, to empirically treat with cefazolin or cloxacillin if you've got a 19 to 25% risk of it being an MRSA. So it affects our empiric management of these infections. The next slide, then, are some projections that we were able to do using the incidence rates from the CNS surveillance along with Health Canada statistics. We can estimate that last year there were at least 21,000 new patients identified in Canadian hospitals with MRSA, accounting for at least 6,700 new MRSA infections and more than 1,300 MRSA-related deaths. And I'll hasten to add, these are probably conservative numbers. They don't take into account community-associated MRSA, for example, or MRSA in long-term care facilities. And when we do our cost estimates, the attributable costs associated with MRSA in Canadian hospitals last year were probably in excess of $250 million, a huge burden of disease to our healthcare system at a time when we, all of us, are facing enormous financial constraints. The next slide further adds to the mountain of data that is accumulated to illustrate the huge impact MRSA has. And there are many studies I've just referenced to here showing both attributable mortality and morbidity associated with MRSA infections over and above that caused by susceptible strains of Staph aureus. Clearly, the organism is associated with prolonged length of hospital stay, and as I've pointed out, excess costs. That $250 million estimate that I alluded to comes from the one and only Canadian costing study that has been published that I'm aware of. It was a study that we actually did in our own hospital a few years ago, where the excess attributable cost on average for a single MRSA infection was about $14,360. The next slide is an illustration of a meta-analysis looking at the impact of Staph aureus bacteremia on mortality rates. The summary statistic there is at the bottom, where on average there was about twice the increased risk of dying from MRSA bacteremia as compared to having sensitive strains of Staph aureus in the blood. Now, you might argue some of this increased mortality is because you're dealing with sicker patients picking up MRSA in the first place, and that's true, but in many of these studies, when they did logistic regression analysis to try to account for comorbidities and other risks that may be associated with an increased risk of mortality, even then, MRSA was a significant independent risk factor for dying of their bacteremic infection. The next slide shows similar data, only here it's MRSA surgical site infections, again illustrating increased risk of dying, prolonged hospital stay, and excess costs associated with MRSA as compared to susceptible Staph aureus surgical site infections. So the next slide then asks the question, if there is a greater risk of an adverse outcome associated with MRSA, why should that be true? And I think there are at least three possible responses. My suspicion is that they all play a role. One, I've already alluded to the possible contribution of host factors. That is, we know in many studies that the sicker you are in hospital, the more likely you are to pick up MRSA anyway. So if you have multiple underlying diseases, comorbidities, if you're in an intensive care unit, you're at greater risk of picking up MRSA to begin with. So it wouldn't be a surprise that your outcome isn't going to be as good. A second possible explanation is related to organism virulence factors. Maybe MRSA is more virulent than susceptible Staph aureus. There's actually no good evidence to support that, with the exception of the community-associated strains of MRSA, and I'm going to come back to talk about that in a few minutes. A third factor, however, I think probably relates to the delay in instituting effective therapy. Certainly, if you don't know that you're dealing with a resistant strain, so you start on treatment with cefazolin or cloxacillin, which is not going to be effective, and it's only 2 or 3 days later that you find out in the lab that, oops, it was MRSA, and then you switch to vanco, it's possible that that delay in starting effective therapy may result in an adverse outcome. Or even if you started vancomycin on day one, there is increasing evidence that vancomycin is just not as good a drug. It's not that effective against MRSA. So even our best drug is not as good as we would like. And certainly there is data to suggest that vancomycin is less effective against MRSA than cloxacillin or cefazolin would be if we had susceptible Staph aureus. So all of that, of course, is an impetus for trying to do our best to prevent MRSA infections from occurring in the first place. Now, with all that background about MRSA being awful, all of us who have been in this field for any length of time are aware that MRSA has historically been largely hospital and healthcare associated, typically affecting older aged individuals, multiple underlying diseases, some exposure to hospitals or the healthcare system, often also previous exposure to antibiotics. All of that has changed in the last decade, as illustrated in the next slide, which is a graph of data coming from San Francisco. And although this is San Francisco data, this applies to virtually every major urban city in North America, including most Canadian cities who are now experiencing the same phenomenon, although perhaps lagging behind the United States to a certain degree. But here in the San Francisco data, you can see the top line in blue refers to all Staph aureus infections. And the rates were relatively stable from 1996 to about 2002. Suddenly in 2002, overall Staph aureus infections dramatically increased. Most of that increase, as you can see in the red line, was related to MRSA infections. So all of a sudden, MRSA took off in 2001 and 2002. And most of that MRSA, as the lighter shades of blue show, were related to community-associated strains of MRSA. And so what San Francisco and other major American cities experienced in the early part of this decade was a dramatic rise of community-associated MRSA infections. And by this, I mean this occurred in patients without the usual accepted healthcare-associated variables. They were often younger, they had not had any hospital exposure, often had no other comorbidities or underlying diseases, had not previously been exposed to antibiotics. So this was a huge shift in the paradigm. The next slide shows a surveillance that was conducted in 11 American cities in 2004, looking at skin and soft tissue infections in patients admitted to their or at least presenting to their emergency departments. And by 2004, MRSA had become the single most common pathogen identified in skin and soft tissue infections. And almost all of these, 97%, were community-associated strains. The next slide actually is Canadian data trying to replicate that American study in emergency departments, and this has just been published in the Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine, a study done by Heather Adam and Kevin Katz involving 7 emergency departments in the Greater Toronto area doing similar surveillance from March to June 2007. Again, patients with skin and soft tissue infections presenting to emergency departments, and again, MRSA became much more common. Prior, if this study had been done in the year 2000 or 2001, MRSA might have accounted for 1 or 2% of all the Staph aureus. Here it was 18%, and again, more than half of these were community-associated strains. So I think we're just lagging behind the United States, but the trend is exactly the same. The next slide just illustrates CNS data that also confirms this phenomenon happening across the country. In the early years of CNS surveillance, prior to 2003, community-associated disease was estimated to occur in no more than about 7% of all the cases admitted to hospital. But in the last few years of the surveillance, this had risen to 21%, and in 2007, it was almost 24%. So about a quarter of all cases admitted to Canadian hospitals with MRSA infection were thought to have community-acquired or community-associated disease. The next slide just points out that most of these community-associated cases represent a small number of clones or strains. The most common one is known as CMRSA10, or in the United States it's referred to as USA300. Second most common is referred to as CMRSA7, also known as USA400. And the next slide with a map of Canada just illustrates the spread of these strains across the country. And I recognize Quebec and the Maritimes are not included in this map for the moment because there were no specific publications that I could refer to. But basically, you can see that certainly in the east and in the west and in Ontario, the predominant strain is the so-called USA 300 or CMRSA 10. Interestingly enough, in Manitoba, the initial introduction was of CMRSA 7 or USA 400, which then spread up into the northern part of the province and especially became predominant in native reserves in northern Manitoba, northern Saskatchewan, northern Alberta, and also spreading into northern Ontario and northern Quebec. But again, just to illustrate, this is a clonal disease with novel strains of novel strains of MRSA accounting for the community-associated disease. The next slide illustrates something that I will be quick to point out is rapidly becoming out of date. But in the first part of the community-associated MRSA epidemic, if I can refer to it as that, these patients were typically younger, often children and young adults. Among the young adults, many of them were intravenous drug users or were men who had sex with men. Many had been incarcerated or were homeless. There were also many outbreaks in sports teams, and there were also outbreaks among Native Aboriginal communities. What are some of the common features here that might account why these groups are at risk? Some of the common features may refer to having limited access to health care, frequent crowding, lower socioeconomic status, close contact, and in many cases as well, close physical contact causing skin abrasions and skin injuries that could predispose to MRSA colonization and subsequent infection. Sports teams certainly highlight that, and the next slide is from a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine where a professional football team, in this case the St. Louis Rams, had an outbreak of community-associated MRSA, and this map just illustrates, for those who are interested, the time course of this outbreak and the positions that were involved. But it was identified that there were a number of practices in the locker room that probably contributed to the spread of this, including sharing of personal equipment, sharing of towels, sharing of shavers and shaving razors and so forth that probably contributed to the spread of MRSA in the locker room. These sports outbreaks have occurred in professional teams, amateur teams, as well as university and high school teams, usually where there's been physical contact such as football, but also soccer, fencing, wrestling have been other examples of teams that have been affected. The next slide summarizes the major clinical presentations associated with community-associated MRSA, and far and away most common are skin and soft tissue infections, ranging from furuncles to boils to abscesses, cellulitis, even necrotizing fasciitis has been described. Second most common and probably the scariest of all, the most severe disease, has been necrotizing pneumonias, which often have occurred post-influenza. And of course, we're all aware of the current influenza epidemic, and we expect that we will see secondary bacterial pneumonias following influenza, and a proportion of these will be severe, possibly fatal community-associated MRSA post-influenza necrotizing pneumonias. But as with any strain of Staph aureus, as with any strain of MRSA, the community-associated strains may cause disease at any site. The next slide is just an example of a severe furuncle or severe boil on the finger. Next slide illustrates a deep, painful soft tissue abscess due to MRSA. And I think it's important to note that many of these skin and soft tissue infections are deep, painful, very uncomfortable, often associated with fever and require incision and drainage. And in addition, are also associated with recurrences. So some of these patients come back with recurrent boils, recurrent abscesses every few weeks or every few months. The next slide is an admission chest x-ray of someone who had who came in with a 2 to 3 day history of fever, chills, pleuritic chest pain, and a productive cough. And as you can see on their x-ray, there's patchy infiltrates in the left lower lobe, and for all the world presented as a community-acquired pneumonia. The next slide shows the progression of the x-ray changes, such as by 48 hours there was a snowstorm, a complete whiteout on the left lung, progressive disease on the right as well. The next slide is a CT scan done a few days after admission, sadly just a few hours before this patient died, but it basically showed total destruction on the left with abscesses, bronchopleural fistula, and so forth, as well as progressive disease on the right. And at autopsy, this patient's lungs still had gram-positive cocci. Antemortem cultures grew MRSA, which was typed and shown to be the community-associated CMRSA-10-USA-300. And this was an example of a fatal necrotizing pneumonia due to community-associated MRSA. The next slide highlights something which is, in retrospect, not a surprise. These community-associated strains, although initially community-associated, as the name implies, have demonstrated a very good ability to be transmitted in hospitals as well. So in other words, you have community-associated strains in patients admitted to hospital and then have spread of their organism while they are hospitalized. And this slide just illustrates a number of examples, and again, it's by no means an encyclopedic list, but there have been outbreaks occurring of postpartum infections occurring in obstetrical units as well as in neonatal units. There's been outbreaks of prosthetic joint infections and indeed of other surgical site infections. In addition, in Atlanta, the community-associated strain USA-300 accounted for 28% of all the healthcare-associated bacteremias and 20% of the nosocomial MRSA bloodstream infections. And in many hospitals now, the community-associated strain USA-300 is the most common cause of nosocomial MRSA infections. So this is not just a community-associated organism. And indeed, I think it's important to recognize that this organism has evolved rapidly in front of our own eyes, such that the term community-associated is in fact not a helpful term anymore because it's occurring as a common cause of healthcare-associated disease as well. And so it's not very a useful term any longer. The next slide refers to some of the virulence factors that have been associated, because the clinical and epidemiologic impression was that these community-associated strains, the USA 300s and 400s, appeared to spread more easily and to cause more significant disease. So that's the clinical and epidemiologic impression. That is borne out when you use animal models to study virulence. And in this case, if you are a mouse and you're injected with MRSA so that it's in your bloodstream, you are more likely to die if you've got a USA 300 or a USA 400 strain than if you're injected with susceptible Staph aureus or if you're injected with the usual healthcare-associated MRSA. In addition, these USA 300 and USA 400 strains appear to be more resistant to killing by human polymorphs, and that may explain the enhanced virulence. So there is good evidence that these strains are of greater concern even than the traditional healthcare-associated strains that we've been accustomed to over the past many decades. what the actual virulence factor is that accounts for this increased morbidity and mortality with the community-associated strains is not entirely known. There's been a lot of interest that you may be aware of in PVL. PVL stands for Panton Valentine Leukocidin. This is a toxin that is produced by virtually all of the community-associated strains of MRSA, but is rarely produced by other strains of MRSA or even by susceptible strains of Staph aureus. And as the name implies, leukocidin, it is toxic to white blood cells. It punches holes in the cell membranes and causes the white blood cells to die. So it would make sense that this might be an important virulence factor, and as I've said, is found in almost all of these strains. However, its role in actually causing disease is controversial. And there are some studies that suggest, yes, it is an important virulence factor, others that suggest it is an excellent marker for the community-associated MRSA, but may not be the actual virulence factor accounting for the more severe disease. And so there's intense interest in trying to actually determine is PVL important or not, and what other important virulence factors might exist. The next question was a Toronto Globe and Mail headline from 2 years ago now, I guess October 2007, but I think it really illustrates a couple of things, because Canada by and large has not been very litigious, certainly not as nearly as much as in the United States or even in other countries around the world. But as the public is increasingly becoming aware of MRSA and becoming increasingly aware of potential for acquisition of MRSA in hospital settings, and of the very powerful advocacy from patient safety movement and the Patient Safety Institute, more and more individuals are starting to sue hospitals claiming that they acquired MRSA in hospital when this was potentially a preventable occurrence, and therefore seeking claims for injuries encountered because of their nosocomial acquisition of MRSA. Now, I'm not aware at this point in time of any successful suits, but just to keep in mind that the public is becoming very aware of this, and certainly hospitals are therefore becoming at risk. Now, of course, that's not our motivation for trying to protect our patients, but it is just an added point to be aware of. So in my next slide, I ask, is it actually possible to control the spread of MRSA? Because I have to tell you, for many years when I've gone to conferences in many other parts of the world where MRSA rates were substantially higher than that in Canada, my international colleagues would frequently say, you're crazy to even try to control MRSA. You're never going to succeed. You're just going to put in enormous amounts of resources, spend lots of money, and at the end of the day, you're not going to have any success. So I'm going to try to address the question of whether it is possible to control the spread of MRSA, and from that see if we can learn what measures are actually effective. The next slide merely highlights, I think, the three primary strategies that may be employed, and they're not meant to be mutually exclusive at all. One could employ any one of these, or preferably even some in combination. And I've indicated three potential strategies: implementation of contact or barrier precautions, including hand hygiene. Secondly, a role for screening or surveillance for MRSA to identify the asymptomatically colonized reservoir. And thirdly, decolonization as a strategy. I will very quickly mention that I am not going to address decolonization in this presentation. Time does not permit it. That in itself is a very large and controversial subject, and so I'm not going to address decolonization today. But I would like to look at the evidence, if any, for the implementation of contact precautions and screening. The next slide are guidelines that I think you are all familiar with in infection prevention and control. The standard recommended elements of implementing contact precautions, namely housing such a patient, preferably in a private room, or if a private room is not available, to cohort like patients together. Again, a critical emphasis on hand hygiene, recognizing that far and away the major source of transmission is hand-to-hand, person-to-person direct contact, and the best way to interrupt that transmission, therefore, would appear to be hand washing, hand hygiene. Thirdly, to assist in that, to actually use a physical barrier such as gloves, and therefore to don gloves on entering the patient room and to remove the gloves on exiting. Fourthly, gowns for contact with the patient or with the patient's environment. Fifthly, limiting patient movement out of the room. And finally, to dedicate patient care equipment such that blood pressure cuffs, stethoscopes, and other personal care items are used just in that room on that one patient rather than being spread to others. So what's the evidence that this works? And just before providing some of the evidence, I'll quickly mention the rationale for hand hygiene seems pretty clear, I think. Again, direct contact on our skin, you want to remove that physically with appropriate hand hygiene. Similarly, I think it's pretty clear what the role of gloves would be as an additional barrier, provided the gloves are used appropriately, put on and removed appropriately, and obviously doesn't go from room to room or patient to patient. The rationale for gowns is perhaps a little less clear, but there have been several studies, many by John Boyce in Rhode Island, showing that when you go into the room of a patient who is colonized or infected with MRSA, you can get MRSA on our clothing. And from our clothing, we can then contaminate our hands and therefore defeat the use of gloves and hand hygiene if you pick it up from your clothing at a later time. And therefore, gowns might make sense as well. The others, I think, are very clear. You'll notice the standard contact precautions, certainly as recommended by the CDC or HCPCS, do not include use of masks for these precautions. And again, there isn't good data about the use of masks, but there might be a rationale for masks, less so because you're worried about inhaling the organism, but more so for two possible reasons. One, since the major reservoir for MRSA is in the anterior nares, wearing a mask might provide a physical barrier so that inadvertently, if your gloved or ungloved hand comes to your face and around your nose, you might prevent nasal colonization by the use of a mask. And secondly, from a behavioral perspective, there's some, albeit weak, evidence to suggest if you're forced to put on a mask as part of the routine, you may actually take more care with all of the contact precautions than if you didn't have a mask in place at all. That's pretty wishy-washy evidence. But again, there is some potential rationale for the use of masks, although I'm not aware of any data to actually say that masks play an established or proven role in MRSA transmission reduction. So the next slide gives us, I think, the best data to show that contact precautions actually do work in decreasing MRSA transmission. It's not perfect. There is never going to be a perfect system, but there is a significant reduction in MRSA transmission. If you have a patient who is known to have MRSA and they're in isolation with these precautions, there is a 16-fold lower risk of MRSA transmission than if that patient were not isolated because you weren't aware that they had MRSA. So I think this is pretty definitive data that contact precautions, when they're applied appropriately, do work, and they do decrease MRSA transmission. The problem, as I'm sure most of you know, though, is that this is contingent on actually recognizing the patient as being MRSA colonized or infected. And all of you, I'm sure, are aware of what's shown on the next slide, namely the iceberg phenomenon, which, of course, doesn't only apply to MRSA. It applies to many other infections. But certainly, as far as MRSA is concerned, if you only rely on detecting MRSA patients based on signs or symptoms of infection, you're really only going to recognize the tip of the iceberg. There will be a much larger reservoir of asymptomatic colonized patients who would not be recognized just by doing clinical cultures when an infection is suspected. This has been confirmed in study after study, so it's no surprise. So as the next slide illustrates, this has led to the recommendation of active surveillance or active screening in order to actually find, identify, detect the asymptomatic MRSA carriers, and then implementing contact precautions for patients who are identified as being either infected or colonized. And note, for this strategy to work, the two must be applied together. Contact precautions alone have not been effective in reducing the spread of MRSA because of the asymptomatic reservoir. Active surveillance without the contact precautions won't work either. You would need the two together. What's the evidence that this combined strategy works? I'll discuss that in just a moment. Before that, I want to highlight one of the concerns about the active surveillance, of course, is that it's quite laborious and labor-intensive. It means someone's got to identify patients, take the appropriate swabs, send them to the lab, and there's a workload on the lab. And until recently, conventional culture methods to detect MRSA typically took a minimum of 3 days, often 4, sometimes even 5 days, before you were able to confirm whether MRSA was present or not. Well, at least from the laboratory's perspective, there's now some good news. And I'm sorry, just before that, just to highlight, there are a number of MRSA screening strategies. I'm sorry, the next slide. Looking where you can screen high-risk patients on admission. You can look at high-risk inpatient units, such as intensive care units. You can look at previously known colonized patients or their contacts. You can do periodic point prevalence surveys. And more recently, there's been a focus on perhaps doing universal screening. That is, every patient who's admitted to hospital gets a screening test done. And again, I'll allude in a moment to some studies that looked at the role of universal screening. But my next slide comes back to the good news in the lab. That is, there are now newer media available that allow for much more rapid identification of MRSA. And the 3 or 4 days that it used to take can now be halved to 1 or perhaps 2 days using new chromogenic media. There's one example shown here on this slide, this media called MRSA Select. There are a number of other media that are available. And even more, potentially more exciting, are PCR-based methods. As illustrated in the next slide, there are currently 2 FDA-licensed PCR-based systems that are available, one by BD Genome and the other the Gene Expert system. These are PCR-based methods that can detect MRSA directly from nasal swabs in a matter of hours, assuming that you do the test as the specimens come in. So there is the ability now to more rapidly identify MRSA as part of your screening protocols. So as I mentioned, what's the evidence that this is effective? And the next slide really summarizes the evidence. There are ecologic studies, there are a number of observational quasi-experimental studies, and there are also mathematical modeling studies. You'll note the definitive gold standard study, namely a randomized controlled trial, is not here because to date there's been no published randomized controlled study that has tried to look at the effectiveness of active surveillance and contact precautions. I will mention that there was a randomized controlled trial presented at the SHEA meeting, I think 2 years ago now, and that that study has been submitted as a manuscript that is currently under review, and I have no doubt will be published in the not-too-distant future. I can also comment that when you come to look at the study, it'll basically show, it'll be a negative study. It will not demonstrate effectiveness of this strategy, but I would encourage you to look very carefully at the methods in order to understand the study limitations, because in my mind there were significant study limitations that perhaps explain why that particular randomized controlled trial failed to demonstrate effectiveness of combining active surveillance with contact precautions. Outside of that study, I think the bulk of evidence, and again on this slide there's just a handful of the papers, but there are dozens of ecologic studies, dozens of these other observational quasi-experimental studies that have all consistently shown the effectiveness of this approach. The next slide is just one such example, Huang's study in an intensive care unit where they added in all sorts of standard infection control measures, and it was only when they combined that with the active screening to identify the asymptomatic reservoir that they had success. So this is one example of a so-called ecologic study showing it worked. And in their setting, that success was sustained so long as they continued with the combined strategy of screening and contact precautions. The next slide is the first of 2 studies I'm going to refer to that looked at universal screening, that is, screening everyone who comes into hospital. And the first study here by Harbarth, published last year in JAMA, is a study done in Geneva. It was a cohort crossover study, only surgical patients, where they used universal screening with PCR-based methods plus contact isolation, and they also happened to use topical decolonization. And they were disappointed in their study to find there was no decrease in nosocomial MRSA transmission and no decrease in nosocomial MRSA infections. Now, in their study, they started off with a relatively low rate of MRSA to begin with, and in addition, they were only looking at surgical patients, so it really wasn't universal screening, that is to say, did not cover the whole hospital. In contrast, the next slide is from Ari Robicek in Chicago. They did an observational cohort study comparing to historic controls, which also has a number of limitations, but they also used PCR-based universal screening, implementation of contact precautions, as well as topical decolonization, and they did find a substantial decrease in nosocomial MRSA infections. I think that is a useful study. Now, to me, this does not necessarily mean universal screening with PCR is what's required, because their historic controls didn't have any screening at all. So they went from doing nothing to suddenly PCR-based universal screening. And I think, I'm not sure that it was universal screening and PCR that made the difference. It was the fact that they were doing some screening as well as their other measures that helped. And again, just provides further evidence to show that screening plus contact precautions are helpful. Again, it's unclear what the role of topical decolonization is. In the next slide, again, trying to address the issue of how important PCR-based methods are versus chromogenic media. As I've said, PCR potentially, if you're doing the test repeatedly throughout the day, can give you a 2 or 3 hour turnaround, which is potentially a huge advantage. Chromogenic media, as I say, may take a day or two. So this was a study done in the United Kingdom, and basically they found that with culture, the median time to report MRSA was 47 hours. With PCR, where they batched their test, I think twice a day, the median turnaround was 21 hours. And at least in that study, PCR did not offer any advantage over using culture-based methods. And then the next slide is the Dutch experience. As you'll recall from that map of Europe I showed earlier on, Netherlands has one of the lowest rates as a nation. And probably the reason for that is their very aggressive infection prevention and control measures. They've termed it the search and destroy policy. They do very aggressive screening of patients and staff. They have very strict isolation. They also do routine decolonization if you're found to be MRSA positive. Very stringent environmental cleaning and outbreak control. And related to outbreak control, in talking to my Dutch colleagues, if they have a single unexplained nosocomial MRSA transmission, that unit is closed until it's all sorted out and reopened, only when they've satisfied themselves that they don't have any other additional cases. They can do that because the usual bed occupancy in Dutch hospitals has only been running around 75% or 80%. A lot easier to close a unit under those circumstances. I can tell you in our hospital, where we often run 98%, 99%, 104% occupancy, it's not so easy to close a unit unless we've got overwhelming reasons to do so. But at any rate, I do think the Dutch experience shows that if you are very aggressive with the infection control measures, including screening, strict isolation, and attention to other measures, you can, on a nationwide basis, have enormous success in continuing to keep MRSA rates down. The next slide is a study from Edmund that was published in AJIC last year, and it actually provides a counter view. These authors claim that it's actually silly to implement all of this aggressive screening and barrier precautions just for MRSA, particularly as they weren't compelled by the non-randomized controlled trial data. And they said rather we should invest our time and efforts in implementing evidence-based proven strategies, so-called bundles for preventing infection. And in this case, they were looking at infection control bundles for preventing central venous catheter-associated, line-associated infections, bundles for catheter-associated urinary tract infections, bundles for VAP. And you can see that in their ICU, they were able to bring down their overall infection rates, and in particular as well, at the same time, their MRSA infection rates by attention to these bundles without doing any MRSA screening or special MRSA barrier precautions. So I just want to highlight that this is a counter view to what I've mentioned about the role of screening and barrier precautions. And this counter view has resulted in tremendous correspondence and vitriol in the public letter to the editors in the Clinical Infectious Diseases Journal and Shea's Infection Control Hospital Epidemiology Journal. There's frequent correspondence back and forth as to which approach makes more sense. And obviously, in the absence of definitive data, it's hard to be sure. My suggestion would be do both. I think they both play a role in reducing overall infection rates as well as MRSA infection rates. Now, up until now, I've highlighted infection prevention and control in hospital settings. I think, especially with the emergence of community-associated MRSA, and also with the knowledge that many of our hospitalized patients are being discharged home, we should begin to turn our attention to infection prevention and control in households as well. And the next slide are some provisional guidelines and information that can be provided to patients and their family members should they be discharged into the community with MRSA. And I think this is just common sense. Basically, if they have wounds or lesions, they should be covered with clean, dry bandages. Again, emphasizing both for the patient as well as household members, frequent hand hygiene, especially after touching the infected area or any drainage. Gloves should be used for dressing changes and appropriately discarded. The patient with MRSA, whether they're colonized or infected, should be encouraged not to share personal items such as towels, washcloths, razors, and other clothing. The next slide continues that, again, their washed and soiled linens and clothes should be laundered in hot water using laundry detergent. The patient should be counseled to avoid contact sports or other skin-to-skin contact until the infection has healed, and that other healthcare providers should be informed about the infected or carrier state. As I said, I think these are common sense type recommendations that we can be making to patients as they are discharged from hospital. And I think, as I say, until recently, we've sort of ignored patients on discharge with MRSA, but I think it is time long overdue now that we address that concern as well. Certainly, household transmission of MRSA has been well recognized. The next slide, nearing the end, is a very powerful and dramatic photograph of how easily MRSA ends up on our hands. This is a healthcare provider who went into the room of a patient known to have MRSA, did a physical examination of the patient, and then prior to hand hygiene, just put their hand in the left panel labeled A on an agar media. That's MRSA growing on that media. The panel on the right, panel B, is after good hand hygiene, the MRSA has been removed. Again, a very powerful image of how easily MRSA is transmitted hand-to-hand, person-to-person by direct contact. So if you move now to the next slide, just to further emphasize the critical importance of hand hygiene. And the last slide, just to summarize, healthcare-associated MRSA rates and its associated infectious morbidity certainly continue to rise in most countries around the world. Community-associated MRSA has also become predominant, certainly in many parts of Canada. Controlling the spread of MRSA requires active surveillance, attention to hand hygiene, and barrier or contact precautions, and there is evidence that these measures work. There's evidence in individual hospitals. There's also evidence in countries. I alluded to the Netherlands, many of the Scandinavian countries, Denmark as well. And importantly, I want to mention other countries in continental Europe that a few years ago had rates of MRSA higher than our own. Countries like France, for example, have had tremendous success in the past few years in bringing down their MRSA rates on a national basis. And I think that can also be done here locally with a concerted effort. With that, I will conclude. Thank you very much.
Dr. Seymour, thank you very much. On my list here of questions that I wanted to ask you, I had the question, decolonization, is it really possible? But I'll leave that alone for the time being, having heard your disclaimer earlier on. I did want to ask, though, on slide number 16, you showed a chart from San Francisco that showed at the very tail end of it, the healthcare MRSA is actually on the decline. And this is exactly the same as Bill Jarvis and Mark Wilcox last week both gave lectures at a conference in Europe, and they both had charts that were very similar. The British experience showing the so-called healthcare-acquired strains were on the decrease while community-based is on the increase. Now, understanding that you're saying that there's really becoming no difference between them, is there anything that we can do to explain why, or is it in fact true, or is it just perhaps a blip that the
Certainly from the San Francisco data here, you're right, there's a slight increase, but it's really quite mild, and I'm not sure that's statistically significant, and I don't know the situation in San Francisco. But you're absolutely right, so I alluded to France, but the same thing is being seen in many other American hospitals, and it's certainly being seen in the United Kingdom, where by devoting an enormous amount of attention to this problem, and the measures that I've alluded to, namely a combination of evidence-based bundles to prevent healthcare-associated infections combined with MRSA-specific interventions, the active screening and surveillance and appropriate use of barrier precautions, that has led to a significant decline in MRSA in those institutions that have implemented this successfully.
So it is possible.
Absolutely. Now, it is the appearance of community-associated disease does throw a wrench into the system. It makes it more difficult. And again, those experts that have done mathematical modeling have said that once you throw community-associated disease into the mix, it does become more difficult. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be making the effort.
I have an OR staff member who's gone for a big surgery in a big hospital, and he wants to know, should I get screened?
Yep, that's a good question, and I've actually been asked that question a few times as well. I can tell you in our own hospital, we don't do it routinely. But certainly healthcare providers are at a modest increased risk of carrying MRSA as compared to the population at whole. If you look at all Staph aureus, so not just MRSA, on average in the general population, around 30% of individuals will be carrying Staph aureus at any point in time. MRSA carrier rates overall are much lower. That is to say, in the United States, where they've recently done a large survey, it's currently running under 4% of the general population carrying MRSA. But we know that healthcare workers have somewhat higher rates of carriage. I don't have good figures for overall MRSA carrier rates in healthcare workers. Certainly in Canada, the Canadian rates are lower even than in the United States. So there's a very small increased risk. I think the only, to my mind, if your hospital's policy is to do universal screening or to do universal screening preoperatively, then sure, the healthcare workers should be included. I don't think there's any particular reason to screen an individual just because they're a healthcare worker.
Thanks.
Before we close, I want to also mention that through the slide set, there were a couple of slides that had product names or brand names on them. I think I speak for Dr. Seymour as well when I say that wasn't intended as an endorsement or an advertisement. Thank you for that very much. That was a really good presentation. I'd like to hear more about this, and I think I may have you back to do that controversial chat on decolonization.
It'd be my pleasure if you think there'd be interest.
Oh, I know there'd be interest. Dr. Seymour, thank you again for a really wonderful presentation. I always enjoy listening to you, and you can certainly expect an invitation for next year. Thank you very much. To all of you, we will talk again very soon. Goodbye.